Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Studio B at Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. Tonight we're going to continue our summer reading series with Volume 2, reading from Home Geography by C.C. Long. Stay tuned. So if you caught us last month, we started the reading of Home Geography for primary school students, for primary grades, a bit of either a text for homeschool or granted that it was published in 1894. So we have to put it in its context then. Public school across the United States wasn't as it hadn't diffused as much as it has today in terms of it being mandatory. Yeah, in fact, in all of the states, because education is run by each individual state, essentially, in the United States, not all states had made it compulsory, public education, public school, for its young citizens. So the textbook, let's see it in its historical context, could have been used at home, could have been used in a school setting by a teacher, or could have been used by mom or dad at home. But what it does is it introduces geographical thinking, essentially, to a primary school audience. Those people up to about maybe age 10 or 11 are engaging with this and learning either for the first time or being sort of refreshed in some of the things maybe they've learned already, but this kind of geographical or spatial kind of thinking, the connections between this and that in the world, between the natural world and the natural landscape. So it's an important reading that we bring to this summer series and want the listener to enjoy it as maybe a refresher for geography, but also to kind of hear what was being taught and what was considered an intro to geography for primary school kids in 1894. Lesson 18, How Rivers Are Made. Have you ever seen a brook or creek, a river? Is there a brook or river near here? Who can tell where it begins, where the water comes from that fills it, where it goes? Let us try to understand this. As vapor rises into high, cool air or is carried with the air in winds up the sides of mountains, it turns into water again and comes falling down as rain. Now think where the rain that falls on mountains must go. Some of the water runs off on the surface, down the mountain slope. Some sinks into the ground and runs along in little streams below the surface. It will appear again, bubbling out of the mountainside as a spring. The spring is the beginning of a river. Did you ever see a spring? Where was it? Was it shaded by trees? Where did the water come from? Did you drink from it? Was the water pure and cold? Where did the water go after leaving the spring? From the spring flows a tiny thread-like stream, so small that we can easily step across it. This little stream is called a rill. Other rills meet this and form a larger stream, which is called a brook or creek. As the brook flows on, it's joined by other streams until little by little it becomes a wide and deep river on which large boats may float. At last, it finds its way into the ocean. Where a river begins is its source. The place where it flows into another body of water is called its mouth. The land over which it flows is its bed. A river has two banks. As we go toward its mouth, the right bank is on our right hand, and on the left bank is on our left. Do you live near a river? Where does the water come from? In what direction does it flow? Why does it flow in such a direction? Does it wind about much? Does it flow into the ocean or into another river? Is the water fresh or salt? What grows on its bank? Near which bank do you live? Make a picture of a spring and a brook flowing from it. Draw the tall grass and plants that grow near it. Write the names of all the rivers you have seen. And write the following. Water flowing out of the ground is called a spring. From springs flow small streams called rills, brooks, or creeks. A large stream of water flowing through the land is called a river. A small stream of water flowing into a larger one is called a tributary. The source of a river is where it begins. The place where it empties into another body of water is its mouth. Every river has two banks, a right-hand bank and a left-hand bank. Lesson 19, more about rivers. Let us have another chat about the river. We may fancy that we are following it in its course to the sea. We shall then learn for ourselves many things we do not know about rivers. We will begin our journey at its source. Here it is a little rill formed by water that trickles from a spring or by the melting of snow. As it flows on, it is joined by many other little streams until it grows to be much larger. There is a large word used for a stream that feeds another stream. Do you know what it is? The word is tributary. Tributaries are often called branches. Before we leave this part of the river, I wish you to learn another hard word. You have seen the water run off the roof of a shed. The ridge or highest part of a roof divides the rain that falls on it, so that part of the rain falls down on one side and part of it flows down the other side. Now hills, like the roof of a house, send off streams on both sides. When it rains or the snow melts, some of the water goes down on one side and some on the other. And that is why the hills which divide or part the waters of streams are called a water parting or water shed. Let us now go further down the stream. Here we see it rushing rapidly down a steep slope. Its waters foam and dash between the great rocks that lie in the stream. Such places in the river are called rapids. Can you tell why they are so called? The stream flows on. It has now reached a high ledge of rock. Over this it leaps, making a great foam and noise. When the water of a river falls over high rocks, it's called a waterfall or cataract. You may have seen the falls of Niagara, the greatest waterfall in the world. The course of our river is now through a lower country. The valley in which it flows spreads out, and the stream grows wider and wider. The water moves slower and slower. Why is the river swift in some places and in others slow? At length it flows through an almost level country. It's here widest and deepest. Its course is more winding. Do you know why it is crooked and winding? Because on the steep hillside the water runs very rapidly and is not easily turned aside. Where the ground is nearly level, it runs slowly and is easily turned from its course. You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, where each month we venture into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. Lesson 20, The Brook. From a fountain in a mountain, drops of water ran, trickling through the grasses, so our brook began. Slow it started, soon it darted, cool and clear and free, rippling over pebbles, hurrying to the sea. Children straying came a-playing on its pretty banks. Glad our little brooklet sparkled up its thanks. Blossoms floating, mimic boding, fishes darting past, swift and strong and happy, widening very fast. Bubbling, singing, rushing, ringing, flecked with shade and sun. Soon our pretty brooklet to the sea has run. Lesson 21, Work of Flowing Rivers. Would you like to know more about brooks and rivers, about the work they do? Notice what happens when it rains. Little tiny streams are formed which chase each other down the slopes. See how they cut away the loose soil and carry it off. Notice how muddy this loose soil makes the water. What becomes of this loose soil or mud? Fill a jar with water. Put in a handful of mud from the nearest stream. Shake the jar and the water is muddy. Let it stand a while. What do you notice? The water is clear, and the soil has settled down to the bottom. Follow the streams to the valley, where they unite to form a river. When does the load of mud it carries settle? Here, where the water scarcely moves, we find some of the soil spread out over the ground near the river banks. You've seen a river overflow its banks. When the water went down, it left a layer of rich mud which made the soil very fertile. Have you ever seen the low ground on the banks of rivers covered with rich grass and clover? Well, these fertile meadows were formed out of the loam that has been washed down the streams from the far-off hills and mountains. Look at the jar again. Which settled first, the coarse material or fine loam? What kind of a deposit will be made in the upper course of a river? What kind toward the mouth? High up in the valley, when the river is low, we see pebbles in its bed. Lower down, the pebbles are worn into gravel. And as we get still further down, we find the gravel ground into sand. Examine the stones found along the shore of a brook or river. Some are quite smooth and round. They were not always so, but had sharp edges. Do you know what made them round? When there are heavy rains, the rushing water sweeps large stones down the mountainside and into the valley. As they are carried down the stream, the stones, by rubbing against each other, are smoothed and rounded and ground into pebbles. The pebbles themselves are ground at last into gravel and fine sand. This is what the streams are doing everywhere, and plowing deep furrows in the sides of the mountains, grinding the pebbles and sand into fine soil, and carrying it into the valleys below. Lesson 22, Water Drops Story. Patter, patter fall the raindrops on the brown leaves in the woods. Mr. Squirrel's bright eyes sparkle as he peeps out of his queer little home, a hole in the tree. His store of nuts has been carefully hidden away. Splash comes a drop on a leaf just opposite him. Such a friendly little drop it is, for soon it tells this little woodland dweller of all of its travels. Let us listen, for we may hear too. My home, began the water drop, is in the wide blue sea, where I live with many, many other drops. One day, as we rode up and down on the big waves, the sun shone down on us, and we grew warmer. Each little drop felt, ooh, if I could only get away from the other drops, how much cooler I should be. Then each tiny drop separated from the others and grew so small you could not see it. We, of course, grew lighter, lighter in the air. Up, up we rose into the bright blue sky. When we got pretty high, where the air was cool, we came closer together again and formed a great fleecy white cloud that cast its shadow over everything. Then a friendly wind carried us along, and soon we left the sea behind. Far below, we can see green fields and waving woods. You must have been very happy, said the little squirrel. Yes, it was a merry life we led, and as we floated hither and thither, playing with the sunbeams, replied the water drop. But we came at last to a purple mountain, and a chill wind began to blow. How we shivered with the cold. Then we huddled close together to get warm. We were now heavy again, so heavy that we could not stay up in the air. Then, I'm going down to cheer a flower, cried a little drop of rain. I hear it sigh, it droops its head, as if in weary pain. And I will go, and I, cried all the raindrops near. So down we went in merry haste, the whole wide field to cheer. The drooping flowers lifted their bright faces to thank the little drops for the cold drink. Even the great tall trees nodded their heads in welcome. The grass on the hillside and in the valley must have been grateful, too, for your coming, said the squirrel. It always looks so fresh and green after a shower, but tell me, what became of you? I fell where the ground was brown and bare, stopped for a moment, then went down, down into the ground where all was dark. I met other drops trying to get out, and we went on together, turning first this way, then that way, till we burst into the sunshine again. We rested for a moment in a tiny pool of clear water. Then I ran with the rest down the mountainside, slipping over smooth pebbles and tumbling over sharp rocks, until I found myself in a deep, swift stream where plants and trees grew on either bank. As I was hurried along, I heard a great roaring noise made by the river falling over a high ledge of rocks as a cataract or waterfall. Suddenly, we fell over the rocks so steep and high that we went leaping and dashing in all directions. We rose into the air in a fine gray mist, then sank back again on the foam-covered stream. Soon we were in a broad, quiet river flowing past the grassy hills and green pastures. Then we came to a big mill wheel upon which we jumped, and by our weight made it turn over and over, and thus move the machinery in the mill. Here we were tossed into the air, whirled around, and at last flung back into the river, where we sailed slowly and quietly as before. By and by we saw large boats floating on the water. We passed towns and cities with busy streets and many people, and as our river widened and we heard the big sea waves dashing against the shore, we knew our brothers and sisters were singing a welcome home. And now farewell, little squirrel, my story is done, and I must hasten to my home in the sea. Perhaps we shall meet again some day. I may float down to you, a white-winged snowflake, or patter down, as I came this time, a tiny raindrop. And write the following. The water rises from the sea in vapor. The vapor is turned into clouds which fall in rain or snow. The rain forms rivers which flow back again into the sea. Thus the water is always going round and round in its long and curious journey, up to the clouds in vapor, down in rain, back in streams to the place it started from. You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Do you have an idea for an episode or want to give some feedback? Go to the comments section on the website or to the blog and enter into the conversation. Now let's get back to our expedition. Lesson 23. The River. Oh, tell me, pretty river, whence do thy waters flow, and whither art thou roaming so smoothly and so slow? My birthplace was the mountain, my nurse the April showers, my cradle was a fountain, or curtained by wild flowers. One morn I ran away, a madcap noisy rill, and many a prank that day I played adown the hill. And then, mid meadowy banks, I flirted with the flowers that stooped with glowing lips to woo me to their bowers. But these bright scenes are over, and darkly flows my wave. I hear the ocean's roar, and there must be my grave. Where have you seen a river like the one spoken of in the poem? Are rivers born? What is meant by "my nurse the April showers"? What is meant by "I flirted with the flowers"? Explain. Lesson 24. A map. A drawing made to show a room or a house or the schoolyard or even a village is called a plan. Drawings which represent land and water are called maps. You may learn from maps where the countries and mountains and rivers and cities are that you have seen. It also shows how far places are from one another. Picture a map showing mountains and rivers. The many short lines facing each other represent mountains. To show the very high part of the mountains, the lines are drawn close to each other, making that part of the map look dark. The line winding about, like the stream itself, represents a river. The line, as you see, is made thicker and thicker towards its mouth. From this, you may know that the river itself becomes broader and broader as it flows toward the sea. But you must not think that the crooked line on the map is a river, or the lines which face each other are mountains. If you do, you will learn very little of geography. When you look at these lines, you must think of the real things which they stand for, the lofty mountains with their covering of forests and with long, narrow valleys between them, the winding, gently flowing river bearing boats upon its waters. Lesson 25. Forms of Land and Water. You all know what a pond is. Is there a pond near where you live? Did you ever fish in it? Did you ever walk around it? When a stream on its way to the ocean flows into a basin or hollow in the land, the water spreads out and fills it. A hollow in the land filled with water is called a lake, or, if it be quite small, a pond. What is a lake made of? What is round it? Suppose someone who never saw a lake were to ask you what a lake is. What would you say? What do we find in lakes? Would you not like to sail on a lake? In the hollows among mountains are great numbers of beautiful lakes. In their clear waters may be seen the mountains, the forests, and the sky as in a looking glass. At night, the moon and stars may be seen below you as plainly as above. Here is a picture of a pretty lake in a valley. You see a river flowing from the hills beyond. Into what is it flowing? The river that lets the water into the lake is called an inlet. You see another river that lets the water out of the lake. This river we call the outlet of the lake. Make a lake on your molding board or in the sand near your home. Represent its inlet and outlet. Out in the lake is a little piece of land round which the waters play. We could not go to this land without crossing the water. The water is on all sides of it. Such a little piece of land is called an island. Did you ever read the story of Robinson Crusoe? You will remember that he went up a hill in search of water. When he got to the top of the hill, he saw that he was on an island. How did he know? Have you ever seen an island? What island was it? Could you sail round it? What was on every side of it? What grew on it? What is an island? If there is a brook or lake near your home, how can you make an island? Picture a river and a lake. Make a map of the same river and lake on your slate. Notice how the coast or shore of the lake Notice how it bends in and out. Write the following. A lake is water surrounded by land. The land near the water of a lake is called its shore. An island is a little piece of land surrounded by water. Lesson 26, more about forms of land and water. An island, as we have learned, is a piece of land with water all around it. Now, sometimes we see a piece of land that has water nearly all around it. This form of land is called a peninsula. The word peninsula means almost an island. In the picture, we see a narrow strip of land which extends far out into the water. You will notice that land has water all around, except at one place. What is the name for land that has water on all sides but one? What is a peninsula? How would you change this peninsula to an island? What is the difference between a peninsula and an island? The narrow neck which joins the peninsula to other land, just as the neck joins the head to the body, is called an isthmus, which means neck. Here is another picture which I wish you to look at. You see where the shore bends like a bow, and the water runs a little way into the land. Can you think of anything else that is bent like this? Yes, a bay window. Now, when I tell you that bay means the same as bow, you can almost guess the name for this bend in the land. It is called a bay. You will easily remember that little word. A wide opening or bend in the land in which the water flows is usually called a bay. Sometimes when the opening is in the bend is long and narrow, it is called a gulf. On the next page is shown a narrow strip of water joining two larger bodies of water. The name given to this narrow passage is a strait, a word meaning narrow. As an isthmus connects two bodies of land, so a strait connects two bodies of water. After a rain makes little lakes, rivers, bays, etc., perhaps you may find some already made. See whether you can find in the magazines and books at home pictures of gulfs, bays, and peninsulas, etc. And then write the following. A peninsula is land almost surrounded by water. An isthmus is a neck of land joining two larger bodies of water. A gulf or bay is a portion of some large body of water extending into the land. A strait is a narrow passage of water that joins two larger bodies of water. You are listening to Geographical Imaginations. Geographical Imaginations is a growing multimedia public geography initiative designed to bring academic and everyday geographical thinking together. We believe everybody is a geographer and a co-maker of spaces. As an inquiry-based project, we ask questions and explore themes through dialogues with different texts and voices. Inevitably, our explorations return to simple yet complex questions, like how does blank inform the way I picture the world in my head? And how does that picture in turn limit or expand my place in the world? The main focus of the project is this hour-long radio essay program or radio essay expedition that's broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. In each episode, we make brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. We reflect upon our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. While many of the episodes deal with local and regional topics, themes are somewhat universal, and our investigations could inform the geographical imaginations of those living anywhere in the world. Now let's get back to our episode. Lesson 27, A Trip to the Highlands. Uncle Tom had been telling Fred and me about many strange places he had seen. Last of all, he told us about some high mountains he had climbed. We wanted to climb one very much, so Father said he would go with us up a high hill not far from the city. Mother did not need to call us in the morning, for we woke up very early. The sky in the east was bright, and we knew that soon we should see the sun. We wanted to start at once, but Mother said it would be better to have breakfast first. We put on thick shoes that the stones would not easily cut. Father gave each of us a stout stick to help us climb. Fred had a knapsack in which Mother put some bread, cold meat, crackers, and a cup to drink from. In one corner we put some towels. We were soon outside the city, walking along the road. We passed a village and went through fields and woods. By and by we could see the land before us rising higher and higher. We saw no longer such beautiful farms and gardens as we had passed. In a little while we reached the foot of the hill and began to ascend. As we went up the slope we came to steep, rugged places that were hard to climb, where we needed our sticks. The trees were smaller, and there were many bushes. There were large rocks, too, in the sides of the hill. At the foot, the weather was quite warm, but it grew cooler and cooler the higher we went. "On the summit at last," cried Fred as we reached the top. From where we stood, we could see the city with its little straight streets that look so wide when we walk on them. We could see the housetops, too, and the church steeples. Then Father showed us the village we passed and the woods we went through, but the trees looked like bushes, and some men at the foot of the hill looked no larger than a baby. Down the mountain a little way, we found a spring where the water was clear and cool. Here we sat down on a rock and ate the lunch we had brought. While we rested, we watched the little rill that flowed from the spring. Blue in the shadow, silver in the sun. Down the hill it was larger, and we saw other rills flowing into it. When it reached down the valley it was much larger, and farther down, Father said, boats could sail on it. Before us in the valley lay a large sheet of still water. "Oh, how pretty!" exclaimed I. "Yes, that is a lake," said Father. "How beautiful it looks as the sunlight plays on its smooth surface. It reflects in its clear water the sky and the trees around it." "I can see an island in the lake," said Fred. "Vessels are sailing all around it." "Are all islands small like that?" he asked. "Oh, no," said Father. "Some islands are hundreds of miles round and have many people living upon them." Fred then pointed to a piece of land extending out into the water and asked whether that, too, was an island. "No," replied Father, "that's a peninsula. It's land almost surrounded by water, and the narrow neck which joins the peninsula to the mainland is called an isthmus. You see the bend in the land with the water from the lake running in?" asked Father. "Yes," said Fred. "That's called a bay. Around every ocean, which is a much larger body of water, there are many such bays. The narrow strip of water which a boat is just entering is called a strait. The strait separates the island from the mainland. Stretching far away to the east was flat, level land, which Father called a plain. Scattered here and there were many farmhouses and quiet villages. Little, bright, sparkling streams wound their way like silver threads through the green grass of the meadows. It was a lovely scene indeed. The sun was already low in the west as we made ready to return. As it set, a wonderful glory of color, a splendor of shifting light, orange and scarlet and purple, flamed in the sky so bright. Lesson 28, Spring. Drops of rain and bits of sunshine falling here and gleaming there, tiny blades of grass appearing, tell of springtime bright and fair. Budding leaves are gently swaying, merry glad notes sweetly ring, robins, bluebirds gaily singing, tell of happy, pleasant spring. Violets in blue and purple by the twinkling water clear, fair spring beauties, frail and dainty, tell the story, spring is here. cherry, peach, and apple blossoms, scattering fragrance far and wide, buttercups and pure white snowdrops, tell of gracious, sweet spring tide. Lesson 29, Useful Vegetables. In the heart of a seed buried deep, so deep, a dear little plant lay fast asleep. "Wake," said the sunshine, "and creep to the light." "Wake," said the voice of the raindrops bright. The little plant heard, and it rose to see what the wonderful outside world might be. What vegetables grow in your neighborhood? Of which do we use the roots as food? Of which the leaves? Of which the seeds? Of which the stems or stalks? Which is the most useful garden vegetable? There's no common garden vegetable so highly thought of as the potato. How are potatoes planted? Answer the questions in writing so as to make a little composition about vegetables. Lesson 30, Useful Grains. Wheat and corn are called grain because they're small, hard seeds. What other kinds of grain can you name? Which of these grains is used the most? Which makes the choicest flour? Some kinds of wheat are sown in the spring. These are called spring wheat. Winter wheat is sown in the fall. A few days of sun and rain and the plants spring up like grass, remaining green through the winter. What color does the wheat turn as it is ripened? When it is ripe, what is done with it? For what is the flour of wheat used? What is sometimes done with the stalks or straw? Indian corn is one of the most useful of plants. Do you know why it is called Indian corn? It is because the Indians first raised it. When is corn planted? How is the land prepared for planting? What is done to the corn while the plants are small? When does it ripen? How tall does it grow? What is the stem of the corn called? What are the flowers on the stalk of corn called? On what do the grains of corn grow? What use is made of the green stalks and leaves? What use is made of the ripe grain? For what are corn husks largely used? Sweet corn, if boiled when green, is an excellent vegetable. It is preserved by canning. A large cornfield with its tall, straight stalks covered with green shining leaves and crowned by flowers is a very pleasant sight. Corn is sometimes called the national emblem. What does emblem mean? What use is made of oats, barley, rye, and buckwheat? Some of these grains are useful in two or three ways. There is another grain which we find almost on every table. It is rice. The rice plant, when growing, resembles wheat, but unlike wheat, it needs a great deal of moisture, so the rice grower sows it in fields which he can flood or drain at will. Do you know what people live on rice without any meat at all? Ask your teacher to tell you how rice is raised in China and Japan. You ought to find something to tell your teacher and classmates about the grains. Perhaps you would enjoy drawing some of the grains you have seen. Choose one of the grains and write what you have learned about it from a conversation and observation. We plow the fields and scatter the good seed on the land, but it is fed and watered by God's almighty hand. He sends the snow in winter, the warmth to swell the grain, the breezes and the sunshine, and soft, refreshing rain. Lesson 31, Fruits. Name some trees upon which grow things to eat. What do we call such trees? What fruit trees have you seen? What do we call the place where many fruit trees grow? Did you pick berries? What makes it hard to pick blackberries? Name fruits that grow about here. Which grow on trees? Which on bushes? Which on vines? Mention the different uses of these fruits. The orange is one of the most delicious and wholesome of fruits. It grows only in the warmer parts of our country. In winter, as well as in summer, the orange trees are loaded with golden fruit and fragrant blossom. The blossoms are white and are very beautiful. Name other fruits that grow in warm parts of the country. People who live in cold countries need such food as will make them warm. What kinds of food are best in cold countries? What people live mainly on fish and the flesh of animals? Do any fruit trees grow in very cold countries? What kinds of food are best in hot countries? The people cannot eat fatty food, for that would heat the body. Do we find in such countries grain, vegetables, and cooling fruits for the people to live upon? Write answers to some of the questions asked in the lesson, so as to make a composition about fruits. You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Do you have an idea for an episode or want to give some feedback? Go to the comments section on the website or to the blog and enter into the conversation. Now let's get back to our expedition. Lesson 32, Useful Plants. What plant supplies us with much of our clothing? Name articles of clothing made of cotton. Did you ever see a field of cotton? The plant blooms as it grows during the summer. The bloom is first white, then pale red, and is soon pushed off by the young boll, which ripens and bursts open. The cotton field is now a pretty sight, the bright green leaves, pale red blossoms, and snowy cotton all mingled together. Form a picture in your mind of a field of cotton in bloom. The cotton is now picked. The first thing is to separate it from its seed. This is done by a machine called a cotton gin. Now it's ready to be pressed in great bales and sent to market. It will at last go to the cotton mills and be spun into thread, then woven into muslin, calico, etc. Are the seeds of any use? They contain a great deal of oil, which is pressed out by machinery. What is the name of this oil? What use is made of it? There is another plant from which clothing is made. Do you know what plant linen is made from? Linen comes from the flax plant. Flax is a small plant which grows 2 or 3 feet high, bearing on the top a bunch of pretty blue flowers. A field of flax in bloom is a very pretty sight. The flax does not grow in a pod like cotton. The stalk of the plant is covered with a bark or skin containing fibers. These fibers are spun into thread, which is woven into a cloth called linen. The seeds are used for making an oil called linseed oil. For what is linseed oil used? Do you think people who live in hot countries need the same kind of clothing as those who live in cold countries? What kind of clothing should you think was needed in cold countries? Would such clothes be comfortable in hot countries? There is a plant that yields no food, drink, or clothing, yet it is used in nearly every country in the world. Can you tell its name? Everyone has seen it growing. It's tobacco. Do you think the tobacco plant is as useful as the cotton and flax plants? Everybody eats sugar. Did you ever see a table set for supper without a sugar bowl? The sugar in common use is in this country is made chiefly from sugarcane. The sugarcane is a tall plant which looks much like Indian corn when growing. It's called the sugarcane because it's filled with the sweet juice that is made into the sugar. When the stalks are cut, they're taken to a sugar mill. Here they pass between great rollers which press out the juice. The liquid is then boiled until it turns to sugar. Much sugar is made from the sap of the sugar maple tree. In the early spring, the sap begins to rise. A hole is bored in the tree and a tube inserted through which the sap passes to a bucket or other vessel placed to receive it. The sap is boiled in large kettles and becomes syrup. More boiling turns the syrup into sugar. Write what you have learned of cotton and linen. So that brings us to the end here of our second installment, volume two of our 2017 summer reading series, reading Home Geography, the instructional sort of manual for developing a primary school geographical imagination, at least the very basics of learning sort of the why of the where and looking at the world geographically. I want to just announce that next month we will continue and finish up this book. But until then, I encourage you to go through some of these exercises. Come up with your own. I know some of them are geared towards the younger audience, but at the same time, an older audience could be refreshed. Our thinking about things could be, we could be reminded about some of these concepts. And to come up with, and maybe even submit to the website, ideas of your own that could be exercises to expand the geographical imagination, or I suppose depending on how we think of that process, I suppose we can talk about identifying what it is and trying to understand how we arrive at thinking about the world in certain ways. And so being able to identify some of the structures of our own thinking, some of the content too. It's not just the way in which that information or knowledge reaches us. It is actually the information and knowledge itself. And for us to sort of unbundle that and consider how that world is framed, what framing do we employ too in interpreting and analyzing the world, and then how does that in turn affect a wide range of decisions that we might make about the world. So these exercises here with the home geography are that, I think, this primary level, and in fact, let's not call it a primary school, it's just primary level, trying to understand networks, trying to understand cycles, natural, cultural, and then to basically, I think, find ourselves in that. And so finding ourselves in it has a lot to do with the way we interpret the world and how it is in some ways mirrored back to us. So I encourage you to go to the website and find us, our email or our comment sheet, and submit an idea, an exercise that you might think that could be useful in for listeners of the show to get a better idea of those frameworks. So come up with some practical ideas. I think it's really one thing to sit back and talk about this theoretically, conceptually, but it's a whole other level to go out and actually do it and do these sort of exercises, whether they're, you know, take it beyond just being thought experiments, but actually bring them and ground truth them in our urban landscapes, in our cultural landscapes, and asking those questions and seeking out those responses in the process. So we look forward to our finishing of Home Geography next week. I'm sorry, next month, and I'll create another call for participation in putting together perhaps a list of different maybe tasks or ideas for uncovering your own geographical imagination. So without anything else, I leave you with Mike Allen and his sand dune. Ciao.